This episode of Connect the Dots is brought to you by the Center for Progressive Reform. Our podcast is supported in part by the Center for Environment, Land, and Law at Loyola University, New Orleans. In 2020, the world banded together to fight a global pandemic beyond any scale that we thought was possible. It was tragic, dark, and silencing. Fortunately, this new year is bringing change, and we hope that we are turning a corner. In turn, the spotlight shifts its gaze onto another great calamity, one that's been mounting for decades. Perhaps it's even more incomprehensible in magnitude. It's the climate crisis. This environmental challenge has made a lot of headlines lately with the Biden administration, which is putting an emphasis on reducing carbon and building up renewable energy. Those are top priorities. Among the developments, the administration's requested a $14 billion increase for climate spending and even more for research. And the administration has vowed to protect 30% of United States land and water by 2030. The United States has also rejoined the Paris Agreement. In the wake of this progress, researchers, corporations, innovators, activists all around the world, they're being tasked to follow suit. But what does clean energy entail exactly? How does a shift to renewables affect the average American household? Power and fuel tend to be resources that we all take for granted. And furthermore, most of us don't even know the ins and outs of how electricity is produced. We're merely attuned to fluctuations in our utility bills. And a lot of us, we don't even know what we're being charged for or how. Switching to solar and wind energy may seem impractical to some of us. It could be expensive. Maybe it's just a low priority. Well, that's all about to change. As the nation works to reduce its carbon footprint, the race to establish new sources of power is on its way. It's important, though, to also look at how we implement these new innovations. We have to make sure that they're equitable and that they're accessible to everybody. Because it's one thing to take on solar energy when you have your own home and you have a savings account, but it's a totally different thing if you're renting your apartment, say, or you're struggling to put food on the table or pay your medical bills. For America's most marginalized neighborhoods, investments in renewables are slim to none. Yet, these are the places that we need clean power the most because they're already sacked with gas plants and coal plants and other polluting facilities. So how do we get green energy to everybody who needs it?
Even for energy law professors, many of us don't want to have to deal with the day-to-day complications of figuring out how to supply our own energy in the greenest way possible. It's hard. I know people who are engineers who don't want to deal with, maintaining the solar panels on a house.
Traditional energy production and uses have not benefited the majority of our people.
Cancer should not be something common that we discuss in our neighborhood.
Identities matter in these fields to me because they offer lived experiences as a foregrounded consideration, as well as ideologies and foundations that have been built up over centuries that are often ignored.
There's something just so powerful about children who sometimes aren't even teenagers yet, skipping school to tell elected officials what to do.
You're listening to Connect the Dots, a podcast produced by the Center for Progressive Reform. I'm your host, Rob Virchik. This season, season 5, we're looking at energy justice. How is the United States going to roll out renewable energy all across America? And how is it going to make that rollout equitable? On today's episode, the struggle for power. Solar and wind energy, they're great technologies, but they haven't really been accessible to all communities. There are people, though, that are working to realign the paths and bring renewable energy to everybody. These days, you hear the word sustainable thrown around a lot. I'm all for sustainable, but what does it mean? How can we live in a world that's regenerative, less wasteful, with fresher air and healthier wildlife? People, they're composting fruit and vegetable peels, they're upcycling pickle jars, ordering products made with reusable materials. Corporations are advertising greener practices. In fact, a friend tells me that if you walk through Midtown Manhattan right now, you will see zero waste flashing vividly across the scrolling marquee on the side of the Microsoft Tower. In 2021, sustainability has become a demand, and for businesses in particular, a marketing pitch. Apple recently announced more than 110 of its partners around the world are moving to 100% renewable energy for production, sparing the atmosphere 33 billion pounds of carbon dioxide a year. The company is also investing in renewable energy projects, and it's pledged to become carbon neutral by 2030. Budweiser's joined the bandwagon. The company's UK-based division built two solar farms and a wind turbine in order to brew every single can, bottle, and keg with renewable energy. As a result, the beer company will divert over 700 billion pounds of carbon dioxide from the year. That gives new meaning to Bud Light. States are similarly offering commitments to clean energy. Connecticut aims to achieve net zero carbon electricity by 2040. Maine says it will be net carbon neutral by 2045. Louisiana, where I live, deep in the South, has promised to get to net zero carbon emissions by 2050. And Vermont and Massachusetts have promised the same thing. It's great, right? A world powered by sun, by wind, people and communities coming together to restore the planet. We can do it, but it's not that simple. Right now, the producers and beneficiaries of these solar energy projects, they're generally Fortune 500 corporations, or they're Silicon Valley companies, or they're affluent executives who are behind them. This is primarily because renewable power requires some big upfront investment many times. Because of that, solar and other forms of clean power are created and managed in ways that can overlook those who have the most to gain from them. Communities suffering from pollution, from high utility bills, and food swamps. These are folks that bear the greatest burdens of the climate crisis, but right now they're having a hard time sharing in the wealth of clean energy systems. And if we can't adopt new sources of power across the board, how big a difference can we really make? The best and the most meaningful way to tackle climate change is to push energy efficiency and renewable energy across the entire economy. So let's start by taking a look at what's available when it comes to solar energy. It used to be, you know, that only your environmental uncle in Sunnyvale had solar panels on his house. But in recent years, solar-powered homes are popping up everywhere. Plus, a variety of companies have been established to run installations and track impact metrics. Still, solar roofing is not as common as it should be. Only 2.3% of electricity in the United States and less than 10% of total energy in the United States comes from solar power. Many homes and buildings just aren't positioned in an optimal way to add those kinds of solar panels. And the installation of this technology requires good credit and a down payment. 77% of American households don't meet the basic requirements to be eligible for rooftop solar as the market is currently designed. But we know the values there. A solar savings estimator created by Project Sunroof estimates both the cost and savings that a solar roof can have on your electric bill based on where you live. Adding solar roofing to a home in New York, for instance, may cost $7,000 to install, but it'll save $100 a month in utilities. That's $17,000 over 20 years. In Los Angeles, it's about $10,000 up front, and you can save $90 a month. The numbers can increase dramatically. In New Orleans, where I live, the upfront cost can be as high as $18,000. So for this reason, solar panels are not an option for everybody right now. Plus, renters don't typically have access to their rooftops. it's out of the question. Similarly, a company like Apple can easily fund solar energy projects, but schools, nonprofits, and small businesses struggle to find the capital to do something like that. The good news is there are other options, options like solar or wind farms, some of them built particularly for communities. They're funded by private developers who cover the costs, receive tax credits, and earn a bit of revenue from the customers. People living in the community just pay for electricity as they would any other utility. I spoke to Hannah Wiseman. She is a CPR member scholar and also a law professor at Penn State University. She's affiliated also with that university's College of Earth and Mineral Sciences and Institutes of Energy and the Environment. And I asked her about the feasibility of shifting toward these renewable sources of power. And as she quickly pointed out, getting on the green energy train is still a lot harder than it should be.
Even for energy law professors, many of us don't want to have to deal with the day-to-day complications of figuring out how to supply our own energy in the greenest way possible. It's hard. I know people who are engineers who don't want to deal with, okay, maintaining the solar panels on a house. This is why I think in some ways, community solar, moving to a smaller level of energy, but not to the household level, is a really good approach, because you still have someone other than the individual homeowner or apartment dweller dealing with the day-to-day logistics of getting energy to the people. But with something like a community microgrid, you do have more reliability.
Community solar removes the legwork and, as Hannah suggests, protects against forces of nature. For residents in these areas, they may not even notice much of a difference.
You can island the microgrid if there are rolling blackouts. If the microgrid has enough diverse sources of energy, you know, backup batteries, solar, wind, et cetera, it can maintain reliability so people don't need individual generators on their homes. Yet it can take away that what's viewed by many as an onerous burden of figuring out how to do that the best way.
There are also financial incentives for constituents, various ways of investing or redistributing savings into neighborhood developments.
Community solar has massive potential, especially if we can get creative about issues such as where does the money go? Can you put the money in the trust and send it back to the people in the neighborhood who are hosting the community solar? How can we develop those mechanisms? And even just the ownership of community solar, I think we need to redefine some of the limitations there in terms of who can invest in the project. Can we have different investment tiers that would allow even low-income folks to participate in different ways? Who owns that community structure after all the individual investors or others have put the money in? Lots of thinking to be done there.
There are a handful of examples of solar farms now established in the United States. Colorado piloted a program in 2010 that expanded to 72 completed projects by 2019. By the end of last year, Massachusetts reported 270 completed community solar programs across the state. Minnesota and New York have both hit nearly 300. What once may have sounded idealistic now is finally feeling practical.
One thought is that the electric co-ops that are already serving customers should be able to relatively easily do this, right? I mean, they already exist in a cooperative structure anyway. The people who are consuming electricity already are part owners of that cooperative. And so I think adding community solar in that context shouldn't be too hard. It's also relatively easy to finance these community projects in municipal utilities, municipally owned utilities. It's where the city or town actually owns the transmission and distribution infrastructure, and even the generation infrastructure, or purchases electricity for the residents. The reason it's easily done there is the town or city itself is already billing all the residents for their electricity. And so what it can do is it can say, hey, do you want to agree in advance to pay a little more on your monthly energy bill and invest in the solar farm we're building? So this is what happened in Tallahassee, Florida, where I used to live. Tallahassee just sent a letter to all of its utility customers saying the city's building a solar farm. Do you want to be a part of it? You could sign up for 100% or less. And it was actually oversubscribed. So they built a second farm. This was such an easy mechanism, right? You already are paying your utility bill. just put an adder on there that's specifically for the cost of building the solar farm. It's seamless.
With new options for initiating renewable power structures, it's important to consider not only how we shift operations, but where we build infrastructure and who reaps the rewards. Last season, we examined the communities most burdened by the climate crisis. Some were people of color or indigenous groups. Children also, we learned, shouldered heavy burdens. Farm workers toiling away in the heat, they shouldered special burdens too. In thinking about renewable energy, we need to take into account the obstacles that many populations like these might face and think about how innovative power can make a difference in their lives. Low-income communities are often located near industrial zones with poor air quality. Residents rely on public transportation. They live in substandard housing conditions. These are all things that we know. Perhaps more interesting, their power bills swallow up a large part of their paychecks. According to federal research, households earning less than twice the federal poverty level, that's roughly less than $50,000 for a family of four, those families spend an average of 16% of their income on energy costs. But households earning above $100,000, for instance, those households spend only about 3.5% of their income on energy costs. That's huge. Offering more affordable energy options, for instance, through solar power, could be life-changing. So why isn't this being done proactively more than it is? Lawrence Early has an answer. He's an engineering student at Yale University, where he's currently researching sustainable development. Lawrence has been studying the history and practice of urban planning from both a design and a cultural perspective. In turn, he's been modeling new ways for how we create and consider renewable power.
Identities matter in these fields to me because they offer lived experiences as a foregrounded consideration, as well as ideologies and foundations that have been built up over centuries that are often ignored, but offer really beautiful ideas of a future, both in an abstract and in a very practical real-world way. Something that I also came across in my undergraduate was divorcing myself from conventional environmentalism and allowing myself to expand these perspectives. So there's critical race theory, there's disability justice, there's animal liberation as a social framework, and there's all these ethics of care and consideration that go into these identities and foundations. A lot of the frameworks that have been the most imaginative and helpful in thinking of design have come from these different pinpoints of identity.
Lauren says you have to look back in history to see why people live in the conditions they do now. It's the only way to get the information you need to implement change.
There's a massive number of hurdles for these communities along the range of institutional and infrastructural, in some cases cultural and financial. I'm thinking the American Council for Energy Efficient Economy, they presented this statistic of 42% of the excess energy burden faced in Black households would be eradicated completely if just the infrastructure was as efficient as an average home. There's also the greater likelihood that these individuals and these households will be the ones who have their energy cut off if they're in arrears, is the term. There's just a lot of infrastructural hurdle when you're going into concepts of redlining, financial support, and the actual infrastructure of the houses and apartments.
Even the field of engineering can be biased.
Engineering is generally taught as a non-political science, but unless it's operating within specific status quo, such as, working in fossil fuel or other capacities, it's a pretty inherently political field because the goal of it is ultimately to change things and make things better for people. And I felt like that was the thing that was lacking, is there were not a lot of conversations on who we're designing for, how this is actually being received, what communities would actually benefit from. And there's always just this heavy-hitting idea that the technical aspect is the most important.
When technical aspects neglect some of the conditions in which people really live, you get unintended consequences. In New York, Robert Moses's architectural accomplishments arguably led to better systems of transportation. Certainly, they led to business growth. But his work left low-income communities smothered in poisonous exhaust. It's a similar case in Chicago, where Cheryl Johnson, head of the organization People for Community Recovery, was raised. In the South Side, where she lives, pollution and poor housing have plagued the community for decades. Her mother was an environmental activist who was arrested twice for protesting against the city.
At one point, we used to have over 5,000 pounds of pollutants in our community on a daily basis. It's about 100,000 today as we speak. Because the technology is getting better to capture some of those emissions, but we still have a poor air quality.
A lot of pollutants in question are coming from the burning of fossil fuel, which is why moving to renewable energy becomes a matter of life or death. It's also why it was worth it for Cheryl's mother to go behind bars in order to make her voice heard.
Respiratory ailments, all form of emphysema, asthma is off the chain in our neighborhood, cancer, all different types of cancer. And she just felt that wasn't right for our government to allow industry to make money at the expense of a poor community and infringe on their quality of life. The environmental movement was really about tree hugging and saving the whales. She felt that there was a connection between the environment pollution and the public health being sick and impacted as a result of all the smoke and emissions. Cancer should not be something common that we discuss in our neighborhood. That's abnormal for a community to have such a high rate of cancer.
Pollution inequity parallels the clean energy economy. The media source Green Biz makes the point, and I'm going to quote them at length. They say, quote, the total installed cost of residential solar has dropped over 50% during the last decade. Rooftop photovoltaic systems have become a viable investment for many homeowners, reducing both energy bills and greenhouse gas emissions. But lower income people rarely can access these benefits. And recent evidence suggests that this imbalance is present along racial lines as well. Close quote. Cheryl and her neighborhood stand to gain a lot from renewable sources of power if they can get it. Cleaner air, lower bills, healthier families. If there was only a way to get something set up.
We're trying to get the Chicago Housing Authority to create a solar farm in our community. They did a feasibility study that we got a wind of it. And we say that would be a great alternative to produce energy in our community. We have four or five different neighborhoods who need this to offset some of the electricity costs. And if there's any excess that is created as a result, ComEd is always willing to buy that energy back. But we want the residuals from that to come and develop programs. But we also looking at what the equity part of it for community. Transitioning is not just about building a solar farm. It's what the equity, what type of ownership that the community can have.
When it comes to energy justice and renewable power, another break in the chain comes in the form of incentives. A big reason companies and individuals are shifting to solar or wind energy is because they receive tax credits. However, as Robert Klee, a lecturer at Yale School of the Environment, points out, you need a tax burden to take advantage of the tax code benefits. People with limited taxable incomes don't get a good deal. There's also a lack of awareness as to what solar power is, how it's applied, and what positive effects it can have on a community. Here in New Orleans, Flozell Daniels Jr. is actively working to address these issues. Flozell is the CEO and president of the Foundation for Louisiana and a former public policy specialist for the city of New Orleans.
Traditional energy production and uses have not benefited the majority of our people the way we've been told it has, right? I think this is particularly the case for low wealth and Black and Indigenous and persons of color and others of our neighbors, who've been both left out of what we might call the energy economy and have disproportionately carry the burden of the losses of human life and the evidence of a ravaged environment and economic instability. There's this larger at-scale analysis that I think we all have to start from and build some consensus around. If you understand this country's history and in the current situation we're in, this means leaning deep into the opportunities that technological innovation promises by way of renewables, fighting to structure this future that we're talking about in a way that centers people and practices who've been traditionally marginalized as a part of an energy justice conversation. And listen, acting on the generations-old analysis and wisdom of indigenous folk and black folk and others who know what it means to live sustainably.
There's also the matter of reliability. Hurricanes are a fact of life in New Orleans and other cities along the Gulf Coast. And again, those in poor housing conditions are the first ones to lose power in a flood.
There's a piece around educating ourselves around what the benefits are that's going to be really important for us from a racial equity or just from an equity perspective writ large. We have to look at this through the lens of our disaster-driven vulnerabilities. When there's actually a larger conversation about the reliability of our energy production and what it means for those investments to be more durable.
For Lawrence Early, blockchain offers another solution. Blockchain technology decentralizes energy distribution. It allows for trading electricity by using the network to facilitate peer-to-peer transactions that bypass a central utility or retail energy provider. You can track production of clean energy or use power as an alternative source of currency.
Blockchain ultimately serves as a tool to basically certify transactions in a trustless system. It is used as like a third-party intermediary between, if you have a microgrid set up in a community, between the electrical supplier and the community constituents who are using it. So it's basically just like a record-keeping middleman without having to actually be reliant on a larger electrical supplier monitoring this data. It's something that the community can be responsible for as well. But it can help keep track of basically a credit system that can operate in relationship to the grid supplier.
Blockchain takes into account communities that have previously been disadvantaged by urban planning by giving them power, both literal and figurative power. Here's the deal, though. Blockchain, as many people know, already uses crazy amounts of energy to validate its transactions. So we need more energy-efficient blockchains, too. And there are people working on that.
Blockchain has the potential to provide, in these energy contexts, autonomy of these frontline communities is often intentionally suppressed. Understanding this ecosystem is much more than just the technology being rolled out. It's the fact that there are so many different power players who are actively against this transition, actively against, you know, improving the health of these neighborhoods that have this highest energy burden, have the highest health burden, because they're also, a lot of these neighborhoods are located right next to industrial sites. But I think the first part is making sure that we change the frameworks that we're even considering, these lenses that we're operating through.
So we'll have to stay tuned. What's at stake, as Flozell points out, is the birthright of all Americans.
I believe deeply in the twin birthrights of joy and justice. Those are, by my understanding and by my belief system, two intertwined and interdependent ways of being and having a perspective on life. We deserve joy because we're living and we're here. It is our birthright. And we deserve justice. And you can't have one without the other.
If all these renewable energy advancements sound complicated, don't worry, it's not you. It takes a lot of people with a lot of expertise and backgrounds to make it all come together in an equitable way. But I want to share one final story that proves that the journey isn't totally insurmountable. There's an African proverb I love. It goes like this: if you think you're too small to make a difference, try sleeping in a room with a mosquito. Now, Wendy Gao is no mosquito, but the impact that she's made in the environmental movement is potent and compelling. Wendy is an environmental activist, and currently she's a freshman studying environmental science and economics at the University of Virginia. Before she was even 19, she changed the trajectory of her entire community by demanding and fighting for the installation of solar panels at her high school.
The environmental and the, you know, the moral argument for renewable energy has, it's been around for a very long time. It's just, it's always clashed with the economic argument, especially for a school system. You know, like, these are real questions, like, who's going to pay for the solar panels? You know, where's the money going to come from? So in 2016, there was this economic opportunity that came about for financing solar panels. And one was an economic argument for the affordability of solar panels. One was obviously an environmental and moral argument. And then the last one was the educational benefits of, you know, like, what students could gain from having solar panels on their rooftops. So there's something called the investment tax credit. It's also known as the federal solar tax credit, that basically makes it cheaper for installing solar panels because it allows tax deductions for residential and commercial solar systems. The implication though is that schools and public entities aren't residential or commercial, so they don't qualify for the tax credit on their own. But there's a financing mechanism that is called a power purchase agreement that basically allows a third party to cover the cost and the maintenance of solar panels while the customer only buys the energy. So it results in a significantly lower upfront cost. Consumers aren't paying for the solar panels themselves and the maintenance and the installation and everything.
With that, Wendy and her team had a solid argument, a pitch for change, and they knocked on doors until their demands were met.
We had basically co-opted the, like, rhetoric about, like, it's too expensive, like, how, where are we going to get the, like, money for this? From there, we would speak at school board meetings, we would go to school board work sessions, we went to all kinds of climate rallies, we would table at events, we would work with campaigns. Eventually, we did get them to adopt solar panels for 3 schools, and now they're moving to solarize more schools. When I was graduating from Fairfax County, they were evaluating 150 more schools for solar capacity. And now they're looking into things like electric vehicle school buses, net zero schools. And it's really unlocked a lot of potential for renewable energy in Fairfax County.
Wendy didn't stop there. She has since co-founded the international youth activist nonprofit Earth Uprising, an organization founded in the United States that was spread to nearly 30 countries around the world. She's given speeches at the UN Climate Summit and at the Climate March on Washington. She provides funding and educational materials for young people determined to make a difference. And most importantly, Wendy offers inspiration to a generation that may at times feel despondent towards the future.
That's definitely a real feeling. Things like anxiety and the profound, like, existential fear of our future and same timeline that we're on, like, we have only less than 8 or 9 years to reverse everything and, you know, try to transition to cleaner energy. So I do get that. I've been there. I definitely know people who experience it. It's a very common thing among activists. But I think a lot of the feelings of, you know, depression and climate anxiety are caused by a feeling of helplessness. Before I started my work, like, I kind of felt the same way. It just felt like such a big issue. And I mean, gosh, like, climate change is, it literally is, it encompasses, like, every issue. I just call it, like, the biggest threat multiplier. But I think a lot of those feelings stem from helplessness and feeling like the future is hopeless and you can't accomplish anything, or the greater movement can't accomplish anything. I just tell those people that, you know, none of that's true. Each individual has power. I mean, honestly, the modern youth climate movement is proof that we can make a difference, and we have. I mean, in the past few years, we've made such unprecedented change. And there's something just so powerful about children who sometimes aren't even teenagers yet skipping school to tell elected officials what to do, that I think has pushed climate change and environmental justice into the mainstream. Every single one of us, we're out here doing the work, and we're proof of the fact that you can make a difference. We can make a difference. We have made a difference, and we're going to keep working, and we're not going to give up.
I think that's a brilliant source of power to end with. Maybe the strongest of all. Thanks for listening to Connect the Dots, a podcast by the Center for Progressive Reform. For more information on this episode and the stories behind it, and to find out how you can be involved in combating climate change, please visit our podcast site, www.progressivereform.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at CPRblog. And of course, you can subscribe to this podcast, and I hope you do, and please give us some good reviews too. I'd like to thank our guests today, Hannah Wiseman, Lawrence Early, Flozell Daniels, Cheryl Johnson, and Wendy Gao, as well as our assistant producer, Brian Gum, and our producer, Courtney Garcia. Our theme music is by Lobo Loco and Blue Dot Sessions, and I'm Rob Virchik. Until next time, be safe and take care of one another.